श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानंद.
This narration is to commemorate the founding of ISKCON back in July of 1966. It is entitled, We Shall Call Our Society ISKCON. Prabhupada had laughed playfully when he first coined the acronym. He had initiated the legal work of incorporation that spring while still living on the Bowery. But even before its legal beginning, he had been talking about his International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And so it had appeared in letters to India and in the publication Village Voice. A friend had suggested a title that would sound more familiar to Westerners, such as the International Society for God Consciousness. But Prabhupada had insisted, Krishna Consciousness. God was a vague term, whereas Krishna was exact and scientific. God consciousness was spiritually weaker, less personal. And if Westerners didn't know that Krishna was God, then the International Society for Krishna Consciousness would tell them by spreading Krishna's glories in every town and village. Krishna consciousness was Prabhupada's own rendering of a phrase from Srila Rupa Goswami's book, Padyavali, which was written in the 16th century. The exact quote, Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita, to be absorbed in the mellow taste of executing devotional service to Krishna. But to register ISKCON legally as a non-profit, tax-exempt religion required money and a lawyer. Carl Jurgens had already gained some experience in forming religious, political, and social welfare groups, and when he had met Prabhupada on the Bowery, he had agreed to help. Thus, he contacted his own lawyer, Stephen Goldsmith. Stephen Goldsmith, a young Jewish lawyer with a wife and two children, and also an office on Park Avenue, was interested in spiritual movements. When Carl Jurgens told him about Prabhupada's plans, he was immediately fascinated by the idea of setting up a religious corporation for an Indian Swami. He visited Prabhupada at 26 Second Avenue, and they discussed incorporation, tax exemption, Prabhupada's immigration status, and Krishna consciousness. Mr. Goldsmith visited Prabhupada several times. Once, he brought his children, who liked the soup the Swami cooked. Mr. Goldsmith began attending the evening lectures, where he was often the only non-hippie member of the congregation. One evening, having completed all the legal groundwork and being ready to complete the procedures for incorporation, Mr. Goldsmith came to Prabhupada's lecture and kirtan in order to get signatures from the trustees for the new society. The date, July 11, 1966. Prabhupada is lecturing. Mr. Goldsmith, wearing slacks and a shirt and tie, sits on the floor near the door, listening earnestly to the lecture, despite the distracting noises from the neighborhood. Prabhupada has been explaining how scholars mislead innocent people with non-devotional interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita. And now, in recognition of the eternal attorney's respectable presence, as if to catch Mr. Goldsmith's attention even more, Prabhupada introduces him into the subject of the talk. Prabhupada then says, I will give you a practical example of how things are misinterpreted. Just like our president, Mr. Goldsmith, he knows that expert lawyers by interpretation can do so many things. When I was in Calcutta, there was a rent tax passed by the government, and some expert lawyer changed the whole thing by his interpretation. The government had to reenact a whole law because their purpose was foiled by the interpretation of this lawyer. So we are not out for foiling the purpose of Krishna for which the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. But unauthorized persons are trying to foil the purpose of Krishna. Therefore, that is unauthorized. All right, Mr. Goldsmith, you can ask anything. Mr. Goldsmith then stands, and to the surprise of the people gathered, he makes a short announcement asking for signers on an incorporation document for the Swami's new religious movement. Prabhupada speaks up. Yes, they are present here. You can take the addresses now. Mr. Goldsmith responds, yes, I can take them now, yes. Then Prabhupada says, yes, you can, Bill. You can give your address, and Raphael, you can give yours, and Don, Roy, Mr. Green, all of you can give. As the meeting breaks up, those called on to sign as trustees come forward, standing around in the little storefront, waiting to leap curiously through the pages the lawyer has produced from his thin attaché, and to sign as he directs. Yet, not a soul among them is committed to Krishna consciousness. Mr. Goldsmith meets his quota of signers, a handful of sympathizers with enough reverence toward the Swami to want to help him. The first trustees, who will hold office for a year until the first annual meeting of the corporation, are Michael Grant, who puts down his name and address without ever reading the document, Mike's girlfriend Jan, and James Green. No one seriously intends to undertake any formal duties as a trustee of the religious society, but they are happy to help the Swami by signing his fledgling society into legal existence. According to law, a second group of trustees will assume office for the second year. They are Paul Gardner, Roy, and Don. The trustees for the third year will be Carl Jorgens, Bill Epstein, and Raphael. None of them know exactly what the half-dozen legal-sized type pages mean, except all they know, Swamiji is forming a society. Why? For a tax exemption, in case someone gives a big donation, and for other benefits an official religious society might receive. But these purposes hardly seem urgent or even relevant to the present situation. After all, who is going to make donations? Except for maybe Mr. Goldsmith, who has any money? But Prabhupada is planning for the future, and he's planning for much more than just tax exemptions. He is trying to serve his spiritual predecessors and fulfill the scriptural prediction of a spiritual movement that is to flourish for 10,000 years in the midst of the age of Kali. Within the vast age of Kali, a period which is to last 432,000 years, the 1960s are but an insignificant moment in time. The Vedas describe that the time of the universe revolves through a cycle of four seasons or yugas. And Kali Yuga is the worst of times, in which all spiritual qualities of men diminish until humanity is finally reduced to a bestial civilization devoid of any human decency. However, the Vedic literature foretells a golden age of spiritual life, beginning after the advent of Lord Chaitanya and lasting for 10,000 years, an eddy that runs against the current of Kali Yuga. With a vision that soars off to the end of the millennium and beyond. Yet, with his 2 feet solidly on the ground of Second Avenue, Prabhupada has begun an international society for Krishna consciousness. He has many practical responsibilities, paying the rent, incorporating his society, and paving the way for a thriving worldwide congregation of devotees. Yet, he doesn't see his humble beginning as limiting the greater scope of his divine mission. He knows that everything depends on Krishna, so whether he succeeds or fails is up to the Supreme. He has only to try. The purposes stated within ISKCON's Articles of Incorporation reveal Prabhupada's thinking. There were 7 points similar to those given in the prospectus for the League of Devotees, which he had formed in Jhansi, India in 1953. That attempt had been unsuccessful, yet his purposes remained unchanged. The 7 purposes of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, as stipulated by Prabhupada. Number 1. To systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large and to educate all peoples in the techniques of spiritual life in order to check the imbalance of values and to achieve real unity and peace in the world. Number 2. To propagate a consciousness of Krishna as it is revealed in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Number 3. To bring the members of the society together with each other and nearer to Krishna, the prime entity, thus to develop the idea within the members and humanity at large, that each soul is part and parcel of the quality of Godhead, Krishna. Number 4. To teach and encourage the Sankirtan movement, or the congregational chanting of the holy name of God, as revealed in the teachings of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Number 5. To erect for the members and for society at large a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality Krishna. Number 6. To bring the members closer together for the purpose of teaching a simpler and more natural way of life. And number 7. With a view towards achieving the aforementioned purposes, to publish and distribute periodicals, magazines, books, and other writings. Regardless of what ISKCON's charter members thought of the society's purpose, Prabhupada saw them as imminent realities. As Mr. Rubin, the subway conductor who had met Prabhupada on the Manhattan Park bench in 1965, had noted, he seemed to know that he would have temples filled up with devotees. There are temples in books, he said. They are existing, they are there, but the time is separating us from them. The first purpose of the charter was propagation, preaching, was the word Prabhupada most often used. For him, preaching had a much broader significance than mere sermonizing. Preaching meant glorious, selfless adventures on behalf of the Supreme Lord. Lord Chaitanya had preached by walking all over South India and causing thousands of people to chant and dance with him in ecstasy. Lord Krishna had preached Bhagavad Gita while standing with Arjuna in his chariot on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Lord Buddha had preached. Lord Jesus had preached. All pure devotees preach. ISKCON's preaching would achieve what the League of Nations and the United Nations had failed to achieve. Real unity and peace in the world. ISKCON workers would bring peace to a world deeply afflicted by materialism and strife. They would systematically propagate spiritual knowledge. Knowledge of the non-sectarian science of God. It was not that a new religion was being born in July of 1966. Rather, the eternal preaching of Godhead, known as Sankirtan, that was being transplanted from the East to the West. The society's members would join together, and by hearing the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, they would come to realize that each and every one of us was spirit soul, eternally related to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They would then preach this to humanity at large, especially through Sankirtan, the chanting of the holy name of God. ISKCON would also erect a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality of Krishna. Was this something beyond the storefront? Yes, most certainly. Prabhupada never thought small. He seemed to know that he would have temples filled up with devotees, Mr. Rubin had said. Prabhupada wanted ISKCON to demonstrate a simple, more natural way of life. Such a life, Prabhupada thought of the villages of India, where people lived just as Krishna had lived in Vrindavan. That was most conducive to developing Krishna consciousness. And all six of these purposes would be achieved by the seventh. ISKCON would publish and distribute literature. This was the special instruction Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur had given Srila Prabhupada. His spiritual master had specifically told him one day in 1932, while at Radha Kund in Vrindavan, if you ever get money, publish books. Certainly, none of the signers saw any immediate shape to the Swami's dream. Yet, these seven purposes were not simply theistic rhetoric invented to convince a few New York State government officials. Of course, Prabhupada was now working in extremely limited circumstances. The principal place of worship, located at 26 Second Avenue in the city, country, and state of New York, was the sole headquarters for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Yet Prabhupada insisted that he was not living at 22nd Avenue. He was not living in New York City. His vision was transcendental. His Guru Maharaj had gone out from the traditional holy places of spiritual meditation to preach in big cities like Calcutta, Bombay, and Delhi. And yet, Prabhupada would say that his spiritual master had not really been living in any of those cities. He was always in Vaikuntha, the spiritual world, because of his absorption in devotional service. Similarly, the place of worship, 26 Second Avenue, was not a New York storefront or a former curiosity shop. The storefront and the apartment had been spiritualized and were now a transcendental haven. Society at large could come here. The whole world could take shelter here, regardless of race or religion. Plain, small, and impoverished as it was, Prabhupada regarded the storefront at 26 Second Avenue as a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality of Godhead. It was a world headquarters, a publishing house, a sacred place of pilgrimage, and a center from which an army of devotees could issue forth and chant the holy names of God in all the streets in the world. The entire universe could receive Krishna consciousness from the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which was beginning here in New York City on 26 Second Avenue. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Iti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarane.